Metsville and baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael LeColin. On behalf of my partners, I welcome you back to the Metsian Podcast. Wacky start to the season. What else can you say? Out of 14 scheduled games, we've only played 8. Today was no different. Mother Nature said, no baseball for you. Postponed. So here we go. Let's jump into it. Let's bring on my partners and today's guests and jump into it. Without games, we still have a lot to talk about. Hailing from everywhere, as we learned through these weeks, Sam Maxwell, the converted Mets fan. How are you and where are you?
Well, I'm in the city, classically known as Manhattan, and I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to talk some actual Mets baseball, albeit a little shortened from where we expected to be.
Weird baseball. And hailing from Connecticut, our partner, Rich Spirago. Hello, sir.
Hey, Mike. Everybody's talking about the weather when it's baseball season because it's had such a profound impact on the Mets. And you're right. I mean, they've had 6 postponements, and it was supposed to start 2 weeks ago today. And in those 2 weeks, they've had 6 postponements, which is mind-boggling. Now, granted, not all of them were weather-related, but hey, we have baseball to talk about, so it's all good.
This is what we preach. Rich. Where can we find you? What handle? What are you doing? Where are you doing it?
Oh, thanks. So my handle is MetFanRich or CT MetsFan. That's my Twitter. And so what I do these days, in addition to talking to you fine gentlemen on the podcast, is I do some stuff for Metsmerized Online. Mostly I try to focus on the Mets history pieces and the series previews. So thank you for the shameless plug opportunity. I do appreciate it.
And Sam, what are you doing? Where are you doing it? You were busy this afternoon, weren't you?
Yes, I was. One of my main endeavors is trying to further the research process of my Brooklyn Dodgers TV series idea. However that comes to fruition one day. And we were talking Jackie Robinson Day with Phil Dixon on the podcast. A lot of different conversation about just, baseball and otherwise. So give a listen, Bedford and Sullivan Brooklyn on Facebook, Bedford Sullivan on Twitter, and Blog Talk Radio as well.
Okay. And without further ado, we will bring on today's featured guest, blogger and co-founder of the Queens Baseball Convention, the media goon, Keith Blacknick. Welcome to the show. It's our pleasure.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
How have you been, sir? We haven't spoken in a long while. How has you and your family fared over this last year plus with this pandemic?
Everybody's good. I was out of work for a little bit, but got back in. Fully vaccinated. I get tested for work sometimes 3 times a week. And everybody's healthy and stayed pretty good.
Very good. Positive news. So, gentlemen, like I said, 14 games on the schedule to date. We've only played 8. We lost 2 out of 3 to the Phillies. We split 2 with the Marlins. And then we just took 3 in a row from the Phillies. And obviously today's game was postponed. So there are things that we can get into. I figure we take it from the top. Let's start with pitching. Outside of Dave Peterson's first start, really no complaints from the starting, shall I say, 4, because we're yet to activate a 5th starter in our rotation, and that's because of the way the schedule has gone. But when that time comes, we'll be on it. But in the meantime, Rich, 4 starters have so far taken the mound to very positive results. We questioned the starting rotation once Carlos Carrasco went down, and we're still waiting for Noah Syndergaard to come back. We'll get into those two bodies, but you got to be, I won't say ecstatic or happy, but you got to be pleased or at least satisfied with the performance through two starts to date from our rotation.
Absolutely. When you look at DeGrom, and it's at the point now where if he doesn't go out there and give you a performance befitting a Cy Young Award winner, you're shocked. I mean, and he has lived up to his billing in the first two starts. You know, the first one, controversial decision, take him out after six, whatever. It's water under the bridge now. But he was dominant, and he was exceptionally dominant against the Marlins. Somehow walked out of there with a loss. We can maybe get into that later. But so DeGrom's been dominant, and you expect that. And it's kind of a shame, right, because he goes out there, does these great things, and you're kind of ho-humming it because of the fact that it's expected. But moving past that, Stroman has been – he's won his two games in different ways. In his first start, he got a lot of ground balls, which is what you expect. Second start, balls – a few more balls hit in the air, but really not a lot of hard contact against him in the start Tuesday. So I expected a great season out of Stroman. I said it on this podcast before the season. He's very motivated. We all know he's in a contract year. And having come off last season where he opted out, I just expected him to have a good year, and he's already doing that, and that's great. I'll tell you where I am a bit surprised is Taijuan Walker. You know, I have to be honest. I didn't know a lot about him. I knew his name, of course, when they signed him. But as I started researching him a little bit, you know, you saw that he missed almost all of 18. He went down in April. Then he had Tommy John, made the last game of the season. He started one game in 19. So very little work in 18 and 19. Was pretty good last year. But then you start to wonder, you know, small sample size last year, a guy coming off Tommy John. Didn't really know what to expect. This guy has been fantastic. This guy has been really, really good. So, you know, in Peterson, one bad start, and yeah, it raised eyebrows because he doesn't throw hard, and when a guy who doesn't throw really hard gets lit up, you start to think, oh boy, the league's caught up to him. But he threw a little harder last night, and as Luis Rojas said, he was around 93 last night, which is a little bit more than we're accustomed to, had a great slider going on, and the speed differential between the two pitches was even higher, which made them both more effective. So a lot to like in that Mets rotation, Mike. I agree.
Continue with Peterson. You know, he's effectively a sophomore. I thought he was going to be a rookie because he made it by, I think it was a third of an inning, but I guess he used up his rookie classification. He's a sophomore this year, but nevertheless, his first start didn't go so well. This time around, six innings, 10 strikeouts, 80 pitches. And then Luis Rojas, he's trending very hard this season so far, only through eight games. He's using three relievers out of the bullpen on a routine basis. Some of the matchups have been familiar. Some have been new to us. Nevertheless, let's continue with the starting pitch in Peterson. And if you want to massage the return of Carrasco into this, and what your expectations are with Noah Syndergaard.
Syndergaard, I really don't think Syndergaard's that pitcher that everybody has made him out to be over the years. I really would have traded him right after the World Series in 2015. I think he's a lot of bluster, and he has some good stuff, but I don't think he has the mindset to be the pitcher that everybody makes him out to be.
You want to jump in on this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I sometimes like his sense of humor. Sometimes I think that he seems to come off immature the way he answers comments. You know, that's just unfortunately the social media element that we deal with, probably why some players have just decided to get off of it, because maybe it triggers them. But I think that Syndergaard has a lot to prove. They're probably not going to get a extension done, even though it was kind of just put out there, but that might have been just like leaked out there by Syndergaard's side. Who knows? Who knows what's exactly going on? We all know that Syndergaard needs to fine-tune himself as a pitcher, and especially coming off Tommy John surgery, you know, he's going to have to figure out what's next as he ages.
Jacob DeGrom start push back. Go ahead, Keith.
Sorry, the only thing with like Syndergaard, Like, I don't know how much of it is him on Twitter versus how much of it is his PR team, but he blocked me for saying enough with the Mr. Met stuff. It's not funny anymore. Just, you know, move on to a new gimmick.
Oh, that's great. You know, if you're going to be on Twitter, I don't think you can be that sensitive. Anyway, that's for another night. But Jacob deGrom had his star pushed back because of all this weather and postponement. But 21 strikeouts and 14 innings pitched. He's off to another terrific start. Looks like another great season is ahead. But to start the season, we've had controversy over pitchers using artificial substances. A couple of weeks ago, I texted you guys the video. I don't expect you to recall it, but out of all the names that were mentioned, Jacob deGrom was not one of them. And I think that's just coincidental. Nevertheless, I don't want to believe that Jacob deGrom is using artificial substances. And the reason behind that is because if you have a sticky substance, the ball stays on your finger a little longer, and that increases the spin rate. You increase the spin rate, that increases your velocity. Garrett Cole has been mentioned. All the big names have been mentioned. And I found it odd in that video that Jacob deGrom was not mentioned. Do you guys have any suspicions or apprehensions insofar as that report that started the season? And again, they named a lot of starting pitchers, but Jacob deGrom was never mentioned. However, he, like many other pitchers, his velocity is climbing. Is climbing like a leopard with long claws up a tree. Some people might find that suspicious. I don't. I think he's just that good. But speculation runs wild. Where do you sit with this, Sam?
Just based off of Jacob deGrom's personality and what we've watched, you know, as Met fans, you know, all four of us are Met fans that pay attention to this on a daily basis. And what we've seen out of the narrative that is what Jacob deGrom is weaving right now, I just think that he has, one, too much integrity, and two, too much pride, and also he's hard on himself, that why would he cut corners like that? So I personally wouldn't see it.
Why would any of the other big-name pitchers in baseball do that? DeGrom, like I said, 21 strikeouts, just 2 walks and 8 hits allowed in 14 innings pitched. So, Keith, where do you stand on the speculation?
I think DeGrom's just getting better because he wasn't a pitcher all his life. So his arm's stronger than a lot of these other guys, you know, that pitched, you know, a whole bunch of innings from youth to high school to college. He was a shortstop for the longest time that converted to a pitcher. So he has a lot less mileage on his arm than some of these guys. I also, his makeup, I can't see him wanting to cheat, you know, with the substances on the ball. And the other thing, you know, supposedly Major League Baseball was changing the ball this year, you know, to stop with how many home runs was getting hit. So I don't know if they raised the seams, because the seams were supposedly flattened for the last year's ball on the ball and the year before. So I don't know if the seams were raised so that way you have better grip on the ball or what. So it could be a whole bunch of different things with DeGrom.
You know, Rich, Keith brings up the baseball, and we know baseball announced that they were going to soften it a little bit, put that in quotes, I'm paraphrasing. But pick up on Jacob deGrom, and, you know, I think it's very interesting that no one has mentioned anything about the baseball yet since Major League Baseball made their statement in the offseason.
You know, you look at deGrom and you see something, you see an anomaly happening, right? He's 32, I believe, and he's throwing the ball harder than ever has, and he's throwing the ball harder than guys, you know, 25 years old. He's up around, you know, he's hitting 101, 102. It's just insane. Now, I think if you look at it, though, I think Keith makes a good point, because deGrom hasn't pitched as much. He doesn't have as many innings in that arm as a lot of pitchers because he was a shortstop into college. And then secondly, remember, he had Tommy John. So he missed, I think, at least a year and a half with that. And so that takes some mileage off the arm as well. And now there's speculation that in the guise of the Tommy John surgery come back stronger. So, you know, less mileage on the arm, Tommy John surgery, you know, also missing time and potentially coming back stronger, not necessarily. So do people raise their eyebrows? You hear about it every time we watch the Met game when DeGrom's on the mound. You hear about it. He's throwing harder and harder. How's he doing that? Well, you know what? In this recent round of speculation, his name wasn't implicated. So maybe he's just that special guy. You know, maybe that's what the case is. Maybe DeGrom just is that good. And we have to appreciate that. That's about where I come from. And the other part of that is, too, you know, Mike, you remember when Mike Scott, you know, back in those days, Scott was scuffing the ball and all that. Well, you have to find proof of this stuff. You have to find definitive proof. And they never did. He admitted it later when he retired. But they never were able to find balls, definitively say he was scuffing. You know, you have guys, the Gaylord Perry said he invented the spitball in that long game against the Mets in the early 60s. So this stuff is not – that's the way I take the whole thing in general. The idea of doctoring the baseball is as old as the game is. There are guys who have admitted it, you know, kind of sheepishly laughing, you know, into their sleeve about it. Other guys who don't that we've speculated about. It just so happens DeGrom is somebody who we're not speculating about. And maybe the reason for that is because maybe this guy is just a generational talent. Maybe that's the case. So that's where I am with it.
Well, so far, let me do some quick math here. Bingo. All right, the bullpen is accounting for 31% of all innings pitched. I'm not going to call it into any one person. I'll just say that, you know, we all had our fingers crossed with Edwin Diaz. Dylan Patantis, we know, is out of the loop. And Sam, Trevor May, our big off-season acquisition, so far surrendered 6 hits and only 3.1 innings pitched. So wherever you want to go with the bullpen, and we'll finish out the pitching.
If I have to see another, whether it's a pass ball or wild pitch between the combination of Trevor May and James McCann, I'm going to flip out. They need to, somehow, some way, whoever's dealing with that element of the game, between those two battery mates, they need to figure out what's going on there, because that has happened a lot. Although, lately, over the last few days, the bullpen has been much stronger, albeit Trevor May kind of set the Mets up, as did the runner on second, but the Mets retaliated with that, which is another thing we can get into at some point tonight. But I right now, I think the bullpen seems like they're coming together. I want to see a little bit more of Lucchese, which also has to do with the starting rotation. Like, I can't remember the last time he pitched, and can somebody tell me, Mike or Rich, or Keith, when he's going to be pitching next?
He pitches.
Well, he's in the bullpen. Yeah. Go ahead, Rich.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's starting Saturday, Sam. And I believe the only game he's gotten into so far this year was the Peterson start in Philadelphia, where he looked pretty good. I think he tossed 2 innings.
That's basically what I want to see a little bit more of is Lucchese. But everybody else is starting to come more into form. Miguel Castro is just looking like, you know, he could potentially be really something special. I think one of the issues still is just how many runners Familia is letting on. They're going to have to get rid of him, you know, because he got lucky with Aaron Loop coming and on 2 pitches, I believe, getting a double play. But Familia is, you know, he's just still letting too many runners on, and he's too wild, and he's just not the pitcher he used to be.
Yeah, Familia, 2 walks, 5 hits, and only 2.2 innings pitched. That's a pretty big whip. So, Keith, you know, your opinions on the bullpen. And one of the trends I was alluding to insofar as our manager. He seems to be pairing up Miguel Castro and Trevor May. That's one of the trends that become very clear.
Yeah, with the bullpen, I'm still trying to feel it out. You know, we have a small sample size right now, and we know what Familia is. He's not Familia from a few years ago. You can't really trust him. He makes Armando Benitez look good, you know, at this point. With the pairing of the way Rojas is making the relievers, I haven't even noticed it. But if that's what he's doing, I don't know. Is it just somebody, the way he's comfortable with them from spring training, or he's not ready to take a gamble on somebody else coming in? I don't know if it's going to sound bad, but with Rojas, I don't know if he's figured himself out as a manager yet to make the confident decision of what pitcher he's going to bring in from the bullpen.
Perhaps not. That's a good point. He still does not have a full season under his belt. So what do you say, Rich?
About Rojas and his use of the bullpen?
Rojas, the bullpen?
Yeah. The Mets bullpen is kind of shaping up like a lot of bullpens do in baseball. The manager has his guys that he's going to go to. And clearly, those guys for Rojas are the guys we've talked about. It's Castro. Familia, he seems to like. I can't say that. I know why. He'll use Loop. And the only lefty he's got in the bullpen, so he'll use Loop to get a lefty out. And Loop looked great last night. And he did quite well against the righties also. So he'll use Familia, he'll use Castro, he'll use Loop, and of course he'll use Diaz. And then you have the rest of the guys. And yeah, Dellin Betances, he has that role that in a blowout game where you need an inning or two, they're going to throw him out there and just whatever, just, you know, give us a couple innings, buddy. But that's the way this thing is shaping up. And so, again, we're talking about a small sample size of 8 games. But my concern with all that is, and you can probably see this coming a mile away, okay, you have 4 guys you really like in the bullpen. That's great. Are these 4 guys where arms going to fall off in June? I mean, what's going to happen? You know, if that's the way Rojas is going to do this over time, you have to start to wonder, is he going to burn these guys out? You know, that's the Terry Collins thing where he would just burn guys out. And that's my concern with the way he's handling the whole thing. Is he's going to his core 4, to use a term, and he's going to them a lot, and it's been effective so far. But I'm wondering how effective will that strategy be in June, July, and that would be my concern with the whole thing.
We had a poll amongst the 3 of us before the season started who we wanted to see at third base. J.D. Davis is going to be available this weekend. Luis Guillorme has been getting most of the time there. All right, the Mets are 5-3, you know, but the offense has, you know, given us mixed results. We've already discussed the pitching. So in the days and games and weeks to come, is J.D. Davis an option at third base, or do you prefer the defense? Do you think the offense needs the help? You know, wherever you want to take that, Rich, I'll continue along with you.
I say this with a smile, and I know it's a small sample size. That's why I'm smiling. That Luis Guillorme, the defensive whiz, has the lowest or the worst defensive run saved on the team. And I know that that's because, A, it's a small sample size, and B, he's not a third baseman, and that's what he's been playing. I you know, Guillorme is a whiz with the glove, but it's odd how in the small sample size you can get a statistical anomaly like that. I think his defensive run saved is like minus 13 at this point, which is something insane. But anyway, so getting back to J.D. Davis. That's a tough call. You know, you can look at this a couple different ways. This team has a really solid offense. So you could say, all right, use Guillorme. And you know, Guillorme gets on base. He's like in Brandon Nimmo country when it comes to his on-base percentage. You're not really – he's not a give-up at the plate. Davis, you have, you know, obviously more power. But do you need more power in this lineup? This lineup can and will hit home runs. So which way do you go with it? right now, if it's me, I'm sticking with the defense. I'm saying the lineup is deep enough. Guillorme gets on base. He's clearly much better than Davis with the glove, and the numbers will straighten themselves out over time. So I'm in no particular hurry to put J.D. Davis back out there. I'll take visibly challenged enough, and I know I'm a broken record with that when I say it every podcast, but it really is. So with this team being as defensively challenged as it is, give me the better defender. Maybe that's just the ball out of the ballpark. I'm good with that. I'm in no rush to put J.D. back out there.
So with his potential availability, Keith, which side of the fence do you sit on, offense or defense, insofar as J.D. Davis?
I say whenever DeGrom pitches, put as much offense on the field as possible. Every other game, you can do it, you know, scenario/game-by-game basis, whichever you think you're going to really need. You know, some games you might feel like you might, as a manager, you're going to need a more defensive kind of team versus an offensive team. I think you have two players that pretty much interchangeable with one with a little more pop.
And where do you stand, Sam?
Well, I think we also should have the honorable mention out here that Villar is trying to – Jonathan Villar is trying to win back his glory. You know, obviously we've seen these April type of performances before, but you never know. It's obviously a small sample size, but he's had some pretty big hits over the last few days.
The rest of the offense, as Rich says, you know, it's going to iron itself out. We talked about Brandon Nimmo last week, but we have to speak about him again this week. He's been outstanding through eight games. Let me see, 6 batters have at least 25 official at-bats for the Mets so far. Brandon Nimmo has 28. He leads the team with 13 hits. You know, we like to say that, you know, Brandon Nimmo, he's a walker. He's looking at too many pitches. He's not aggressive enough. But 13 hits and 28 at-bats, that speaks. And three of those hits were for doubles. So, Sam, continue on with Brandon Nimmo, please.
Well, it could be possible he's really coming into his own. And, you know, we have to remember that when they drafted him, they were drafting for potential. Because he was out of American League. He was a high schooler out of American Legion because his high school didn't even have baseball in Wyoming. So, you know, this has been there the whole time. It's just I can pull up how old he is. I'm not exactly sure off the top of my head, but, you know, he really may be coming into his own right now.
A couple of more stats. He leads the team in total bases with 16, and he has 8 walks. You know,
hey,
what would you want out of Lito? And 28 years old, entering his prime. So, Keith, pick it up with Brandon Nimmo, please.
Yeah, I mean, I became a Nimmo fan when he came to the QBC as a guest, and he was just talking about like his love for the game and how he just you could tell he's also a student of the game. And I think he's one of those guys that as he gets older, he's going to get better. He's not going to be a superstar, but he's going to be, you know, a very good / star player. And right now you're starting to see that. Part of the whole thing is getting on base, whether it's hits, which it's great that he's, you know, hitting as well as he is right now, or just walks. But at least he's putting a body on base that the potential run scoring. And for the longest time, the Mets didn't have that except for him. And now there's, you know, players behind them that can actually score him. And I like it. And, you know, the whole thing with George Springer, when, you know, Mets fans were all pissed off that they didn't get Springer, it's like, you know, Nimmo is not that much of a downgrade. So I'm happy with Nimmo. I think he's going to continue doing well. And who knows, you know, sky's the limit with him.
I've always been in this corner. Rich, you know, one of the benefits for me here living in Brooklyn is having the Cyclones in my backyard. And when the Mets drafted Brandon Nimmo, You know, when I go to Cyclones games, I like to get as many of the team autographs on one program as I can. And I'll select certain players where I'd only want theirs on a cover of a program. And, you know, I'll go home with like 7-8 programs after the first couple of games of the season. But, you know, I have Brandon Nimmo's autograph by itself on the cover of a Brooklyn Cyclones program. I'm staring at it right now on my wall, and I'm happy that I singled him out. So, Brandon Nimmo.
Well, you know, the knock on Nimmo going into it pretty much before last season, not so much before this season, was he's a fourth outfielder, right? That's a big joke. And you look on Twitter during a game, oh, he's fourth outfielder. And people are now saying it jokingly. He's not. You know, he's a major league quality starting outfielder. And the thing that I think it was Todd Zeal, might have been Sal Licata, was saying that I thought was so spot on. What frustrated some people about Nimmo was he was going up there looking for a walk, right? And that did seem to be true early on in his career. And he would get called out on strikes a lot. And you would want to pull your hair out because he'd come up in a situation where you need a hit, like you need maybe a gap or something in the gap. And he's got the power to do that. And he would appear passive at the plate. He would take pitches and, again, maybe get called out on strikes. And that's what led to that perception that he's a fourth outfielder. Well, according to, it was either Zeal or Licata saying just the other day that he clearly has changed his approach. Yes, he'll go up there when he's leading off the game, when there's nobody on base, and he'll do the Nimmo thing. You know, he'll be selective. He'll try to foul balls off, and he may get called out on strikes. Okay, fine. But what you've noticed is, and you've seen it so far this season, when he comes up with men on base, it's a different Brandon Nimmo with a different approach. And that is, to me, the biggest thing he's done. He has flexed his approach at the plate to meet the situation, and I love that. I mean, I think that's just heady baseball. He knows he's going to get pitches to hit when there are men on base, and he hits them, and he hits them hard. And so now what you're seeing is the evolution of a complete player. And this isn't a guy who's got a good eye and walks and all that. This is a guy who's situationally smart, gets on base when he has to, swings the bat when he has to. I saw today that he's in the 95th percentile for sprinter speed in baseball, which is really good too. On the other side of the coin, I still don't think he's a center fielder. On a really, really good team, in my opinion, he's a left fielder, and we have a different center fielder. And that would be the only thing. Now, that's not his fault. That's roster construction. That's the only thing with Nimmo is if he could just get to major league average, I'd be thrilled. I'm not sure he can center field-wise. And, again, that's not his fault, but he's a hell of a player.
And can You're I, listening. Mike, can I just say that – sorry, before you reset, can I just say – looking at the service time that it says here on Baseball Reference, 4.042, arbitration eligible 2022, free agent 2023. So this is an interesting conversation to also bring up about Brandon Nimmo going forward.
Room to improve. I hope he does just that. You're listening to the Metsian Podcast, and our featured guest this evening is Keith Blacknick. He's co-founder of the Queens Baseball Convention. Keith, you know, like everything else over the past year, it's been strange. And you had a virtual convention this season in February. Before you speak about that, you know, I if I'm not mistaken, your first convention was 8 years ago. Tell us about the evolution from then to this virtual session this year.
Well, the first one was us trying to basically fake the Mets into doing their own fan fest. They didn't bite, so we did it. Lucky for me, I have a production background, so I was able to basically wing it and put together a pretty decent first show. My cousin from Mets Police, he was the original co-founder with me. We had Darren from the Seven Line who was a part of it. He had to back out because that's when he was getting his license with the MLB. And then we also had Dan Tuick, who's still with me with the QBC. we put our hearts into it. We had Ron Darling and Ed Cranepool as our first guests, and we had no idea what we were doing, and it grew into something that we saw our fans really enjoyed, and then we did it again the year after with Mookie and Wally. Then we got Snow It Out the year after that. Then we had it for the first time in Astoria with Catch. We had Nimmo, Flexin. Who else do we have? Bobby D, I think. Was that the year, or was that Tough? I can't. You know what it is? It's so jumbled now. I can't even remember what years everybody was. But we went from just having two players that were solid players to having current players and icons like Strawberry. Then we did a one-off with Keith Hernandez. We did a fundraiser for Cranepool for his kidney. And it just is. It was always a fun thing to do to see other fans have a good time and being able to spend time with, you know, people that they love to watch or love to watch playing the game.
Well, you wanted to beat them to the punch, them being the Mets, them being the Wilpons. What was your relationship with the Wilpons like?
Oh, here's the funny thing. The last in-person QBC we had was the one that we gave the Gil Hodges Unforgettable Fire Award to David Wright. Jeff Wilpon wanted to come. He wanted actually to show up at the QBC, I found out. But a lot of his people said no to him. I think if he would have came and he would have had one of us that, you know, fair and weren't going to just, you know, crap on him, he might have been able to win over some fans. But you listen to the, you know, the typical, you know, no naysayers in the organization, and he did that a lot. So he kind of, like, buried himself with the fans. And otherwise, the Wilpons, they didn't – they could have tried to shut us down at times. They could have told the Mets executives not to come. They could have given us a hard time, but they didn't. They actually sent Mets executives. They sent – we were cool with them. They sent, you know, ticket reps to sell tickets and season tickets, and they had a special QVC plan that was like a 3-game plan 1 year, you know, to sell. So they didn't hate us, but I'm sure they didn't like us. But they also saw that the potential of what they could use us for too, which was basically giving them good PR and a good thing during the wintertime that they wouldn't do themselves.
I'm going to throw it to you guys for questions, Rich.
Well, you know, you may not, Keith, have this knowledge to answer this question. If you don't, I apologize for asking. But why in the world did they not do their own, they being the Wilpons, the Mets, do their own fan fest? Did anybody ever tell you that? Because let me tell you, they did it obviously 2020. I went to it. And you may remember, I was working in the city at the time. The early 2000s, they did a van that would go around to various places like Grand Central here, there, and everywhere. And they'd have a few players and kind of like a mobile fan fest. But you know, I travel a lot for business when traveling is a thing. And I've been in the winter in these various locations where baseball fan fests are happening. And people go nuts. And that I was in Chicago when the Cubs had theirs and they're a regional draw. The place was crawling with everything Cubs stuff, you know, everybody running around Cubs stuff. Why in the world did it take the Mets until 2020 to do it? And here you are doing it. They don't do one of two things. Either latch on to what you're doing fully. I know you said they did a little bit. Latch on fully and say, hey, you know, hey, Keith and your colleagues here, this is a cool thing. We're going to totally support you, center people, or do their own. Why did they take this half-assed approach? Do you have any insight in that?
All right, I got a couple of different things. First of all, what didn't the Wilpons do half-assed? You know, even when they were, you know, signing players, they would sign that one big player, but they would never sign the extra pieces that would help that team, you know, win. It was always like, all right, we signed free agent A, but we're going to sign free agent Z and double Z off the garbage pile. With us, they they told us that they didn't believe a fan fest would draw. Well, and they never thought that fans would want to come to the stadium in the wintertime or come somewhere in the wintertime and see what was going on. To tell you the truth, I think they just didn't want to pay anybody. They didn't want to pay players to show up. They didn't want to have to pay union fees to run at the stadium. They didn't want to have to organize something. They didn't want to have to pay their staff to show up. So it was, I had a feeling it was a money thing, and also they didn't believe in what this fan base was really about. With us latching on, the funny thing is last year that they just did theirs in 2020, they asked us to be a part of it and, you know, maybe do a couple panels, help them, you know, run a panel room. When we asked them, you know, what was in it for us, they told us, oh, publicity, nothing. And we told them, no, thank you. So I work hard. You know, I work in the film business where I do anywhere between 60, 80 to 100 hours a week. And the QVC, I love it. It's a pet passion for me. It helps me get my creativeness out. But there is no way you're taking advantage of me or my partner Dan or any of our volunteers that help us out or any of our relationships and not do anything for us.
Makes sense.
Jump in, Sam.
Well, so, you know, it seemed as if, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, that there was no virtual Mets fan fest on Steve Cohen's side. So my question to you is whether there has been any dialogue in new ownership.
Nothing. There's nothing. But I could kind of understand that with the whole pandemic thing and when you're coming in as a new owner trying to figure out what's going on. He's a Mets fan. No doubt about that, he's a Mets fan. But when was the last time he was really amongst Mets fans at, like, a fan fest or a QBC or, you know, just walking around the ballpark or, I don't know, maybe he did it all the time before people knew what his name was. But did he really have the heartbeat of what other fans have, you know, wanted? Before he created Stephen A. Cohen on Twitter, was he lurking on Twitter to see what was going on? So I can't really answer what, you know, is in his head right now. But for us, we know SNY always wants to do things with us, and that's why they've been a title sponsor for us for years. That's why they helped out with the panels that they've done in the last few years, like the Baseball Night New York, Say Anything podcast. They've done a lot with us. We've helped them out. They've helped us out. And the Mets, we have a couple of really cool people inside the Mets that work there that are always pushing for the QBC. When Yahoo came up with their Queens Baseball Club, they told them, hey, there's a QBC out there. It's trademarked. Don't do it. And Yahoo's like, oh, what are they going to do to us? We sent them a cease and desist. And you notice there's no Queens Baseball Club. There's no Flushing Meadows Baseball Club. And there's no more Yahoo's doing anything with Major League Baseball.
Keith, we really mean it when we say we enjoy shameless plugs. Please put your information out there one more time for the audience.
All right. This is going to be long. I got a lot of stuff here. All right, on Twitter, I'm at Media Goon. On my blog, which is a fan advocacy blog where I talk about how the Mets treat fans, how the fan experience is. If I hear something cool going on, I'll let fans know. I'm basically like Howard on your side from Channel 2 News or whatever. I'm Goon on your side. You can check that out at themediagoon.com. themediagoon.com. The Queens Baseball Convention, our website is queensbaseballconvention.com. Our Twitter handle for that is at QBC Convention, so our QB Convention. There's also, we have a ton of videos from the past QBCs on our YouTube channel. You can either just search YouTube for Queens Baseball Convention or go to youtube.com/Queens Baseball Convention. Subscribe to the channel. Turn on the notifications because we're always doing new stuff. We're in the process of trying to figure out a couple more virtual events or virtual things that are going on that we're not ready to announce yet. And there, we also have two shows on it now, too, which is the Media Goon Show, which is me and my show, where I have two cool artists, Graphics Joker and Dave Maggio. They both pop on as my co-host every now and then. Depends. I can have both of them. I can have one of them. I can have none of them. And I bring on guests that I'm friends with that I might not know too well, and we talk Mets, but we also talk a whole range of other things. We talk sports, film business, everyday life, whatever's going on, we just talk. It's just my talk show. It's a way of me being me and just venting out conversations I would have if I was sitting next to you at a game or even just at dinner. And then my last thing I'm going to plug is the other show we have, which I had a hand in naming, and you can call me quote-unquote a producer since it's on my channel. It's Catching Feelings with John Saponaro, who's a very funny comic. I don't know if you guys follow him at all on Twitter, but very knowledgeable Mets fan. He's had some great guests on. The last guest he had on used to write for and show up on the Chelsea Handler show. I think it was Chelsea Lately, or it could have been the Chelsea Handler show since she had the two different ones. But John's very knowledgeable, and he tries to come on after games or before games and wants to let Mets fans vent or talk and see what's going on with him. And what's great about these shows, like the Media Goon Show and Saponaro, is that there's real live comments that you can comment to us, and we can take questions or have a dialogue, you know, via what you guys are shooting at us. The technology we have is pretty cool. Even the SNY guys during their panel at the QVC were like, all right, so how do you have better tech than us? And we're a broadcast channel.
Wilpons, because they're still owned by the Wilpons.
It's true. I wasn't going to say that.
That's good stuff. That's twice, Sam, you uttered the magic words. I'm going to start the next round with you. You said new ownership and – you know, et cetera. What happened? The man responsible for the biggest Ponzi scheme known to mankind, Bernie Madoff. He passed away at the age of 82 today. If it wasn't for him, i.e. Bernie Madoff, this team would still be in the Wilpons' hands and not in the hands of Steve Cohen. But, you know, we're looking back on history now. That whole scandal that broke out, I guess we first got wind of that, what, in 2009, late 2009? And by 2010?
Late 2008.
Late 2008, okay. And by 2009 and 10, you know, the fallout was just raining everywhere. So he passed away, age 82. Any reflections on Mets history, so to say?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the trajectory of him getting caught basically ends – with the last contending year for a long time with the Mets, who obviously missed the playoffs in 2008. And then I believe it was December 2008 that he got raided. And at that point, I think it's basically the bottom was always inevitably going to fall out for that, for those guys. Like we said, the half-assed, tone-deaf Wilpons. You know, it's nice that there is a level of humanity that must be there with Wilpon, and he does seem to, you know, David Wright and him, I think, they actually do respect each other. It does seem, you know, one of the reasons, I think if there was any animosity, like there does seem to be with some other players, then it, you know, David Wright probably wouldn't have stayed, regardless of how loyal he was. So, you know, just to the brand, I mean. But it's just crazy to think, you know, I didn't even see what he died of yet, but I hope that he, you know, regardless of everything that he did, I know people are, you know, saying some things that should be, you know, considered appropriate considering what he did to people's lives. But at the same time, like, you hope that whatever evil he had in this world, which basically fueled what he did, that you know, you just, you don't, I don't know, I'm just, I'm, I guess, compassionate, and I'm not necessarily hoping that the end has to do with fire, you know? You just hope that somehow you can redeem yourself somehow, some way, and you hope that by the end of his life he came to some sort of peace, you know? Who knows exactly what was going on in his head? Who knows? It's just crazy to think of a mind like that and what it must have been like to live out your life the way he did.
Let me give credit where it's due. I'm reading the article from ESPN by June Lee. And Rich, by the way, Sam, he died of natural causes. Rich, in this article, it's written that Will Panicato had over 500 accounts with Bernie Madoff, and that Madoff later admitted to prosecutors that he lost more than $50 billion that belonged to investors. How about that?
Well, you know, I'm going to go with Sam on this one. I think it's pretty well known this wasn't a nice guy. You know, he ruined a lot of lives. And I'm not talking about, well, fans, what he did to the owners of our team. I'm talking about people being ruined by this guy, you know, and having their whole lives upended. But, you know, a friend of mine texted me immediately when the news came out, the story, and I responded back, and that's what I'll say here. I just hope people let it go. Let it go. Because, okay, we don't think he was a nice guy, probably wasn't, did a lot of bad things. And I'm going to go with Sam on this one. You know, let the man upstairs sort this out. I'm not going to say anything about it. I don't, it's not my business. I've seen some things on Twitter that are just awful. You know, somebody said, and I guess this isn't really among the most awful, you know, hey, Bernie, say hi to M. Donald Grant when you get there. I mean, you know, okay. I mean, you're a Mets fan, and these two people had a negative impact on the ball club, but let's, my personal opinion, guy's dead. Let the man upstairs sort out what he did and didn't do on the earth, and let's just all move on. But that's my opinion. I'm with you, Sam.
It's okay to look back in hindsight compassionately, as Sam says. But Keith, you know, hindsight, what say you?
I'm one of those guys that, you know, when everything happened and what was going on with Madoff and the Wilpons, it's one of those things where so many people's lives are ruined. I'm not the person that should be judging what people should be thinking about what he did. If you were affected by it personally and you lost your finances or your retirement funds or whatever it was, you have every right to feel the way you do about this guy. If you're saying stuff because you're a fan of a baseball team, it's not that serious. It's baseball. It's a game that's played by men running around in tight uniforms, swinging a wooden object at a leather ball. That should not be – I know it affects a lot of people's lives, you know, whatever their passion is with sports, but I don't get angry about anything that happens to the Mets. I just can't, because there's so much other stuff going on in life, especially like what we're going through now with the pandemic or what people have gone with the housing bubble or when the stock market crashed or anything that's happened. Sports and – you know, it's a great escape, but I don't need to put my being or my anger into somebody that screwed over billionaires or millionaires. But when he hurt like the little people, it's like, all right, I can understand what they're saying. Let them judge how they feel about him. Otherwise, it is what it is. I'm going to like the Mets no matter what. They could have a payroll like Pittsburgh, and I'd still go to watch and just enjoy the game and not worry about what their finances are or how they're making the payroll or whatever it is they're doing, as long as they're fielding a decent team. It could be all four A players, but as long as they're playing with passion and heart and trying to win, I'm happy with it. So if it's a Madoff screwing over, quote unquote, the fans, I really don't care.
And Sam, Madoff aside, somehow, some way, the Wilpons remain topical, or at least I think, because nobody actually mentioned names. But I'm going to bring up Jed Lowry. And the report out today is that the Mets prevented him from getting knee surgery. We know who owned the Mets at the time, and we know who liked to call the shots and get involved and you know, stick his nose where it didn't belong, especially when it came to medical issues. But we have that report, and Jed Lowry, you know, he spoke about his time, his brief time with the Mets. And it's funny that the Mets, well, let's just say it's funny that Brody Van Wagenen was the general manager at the time when all this was transpiring. So I'll start with you, Sam.
It makes perfect sense. You know, now we're going to have the denouement. Somebody eventually is going to write the book on these guys. You know, why, you know, can't anybody, you know, what's the phrase?
Can anybody play this team?
Yeah, thank you.
Right.
Which I'm a little dyslexic right now. But anyway, you know, that's going to be – I'm very curious because that's what's weird about it too, is that it's this weird love-hate relationship because, you know, I guess for me who is somewhat of a cinephile and you know, looks at it from that narrative perspective, it's a Greek tragedy really. And it's going to be interesting to see as stories unfold, you know. I mean, this is exactly what we've heard forever. This is nothing new. This is like, you know, Police Academy 9.
Rich, you know, somehow, some way, the Wilpons remain topical.
Yeah, you know, I did a story on this on Mesmerized over the weekend, last weekend, and basically it's everything you said. You know, the question is, did Lowry know he was hurt when he signed? And no one really knows the answer, but what we do know is that in spring training, you know, right after spring training of 2019 began, literally like a couple days in, he reported discomfort in the knee. And according to Lowry, you know, they didn't let him have the surgery. They threatened him with a grievance. And you could say, okay, well, maybe they threatened him with a grievance because maybe it is true. Maybe he did have this injury and he held it. Well, who knows? But okay. So so that's where you are. And they don't let him have this surgery. And this comical, farcical thing goes on for two seasons, where, you know, he's in this brace that looks like Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, right? He can't possibly play with that thing on. And this is what they force this guy to do. Try to rehab it, wear this brace, you know, that looks like a spacesuit. And the whole thing turned into just a farce. And here's the sad part of it, Mike. The sad part of it is the minute the Mets were eliminated from playoff contention, he was a free agent, right? And this was in the article when I did the research. So that made him a free agent, signs with the A's, tells the A's, look, I need surgery, guys. He had his surgery in early October. He was ready for spring training in February. A couple of months later, the guy was full speed, full steam, ready to go. So if the short-sighted Wilpons had let this guy, if they had gone with the doctor's advice, let this guy have the surgery in mid-February of 19, we'll call it, he probably would have been ready by June. And you would have gotten a season and a half out of him for your money. But what did you get? You got 8 plate appearances in 2 seasons, all of them in 2019. And the whole thing is just a joke. And like Sam was saying, it's history, right? Because Beltran, the same thing. He wanted to have surgery. Mets said no. Pedro Martinez was the one I brought into the article. We all know that story where he claims that in late 2005, they were just about eliminated. He had the toe issue, and he wanted to have some surgery on it and not start. And the quote he has in his own book from Jeff Wilpon was, sorry, as long as I'm the boss here, you're going to do what I say, and you're pitching. So, you know, it's another reason why, as if we don't have enough, it's another reason why we should be happy the Wilpons are gone. I mean, this bullshit. It's a Bush way to run an organization. That's my opinion.
I'm in lockstep with you. Keith, Rich mentioned Pedro Martinez, Carlos Beltran. I'll add Ryan Church. You want to pick up on this Jed Lowry mess?
The Wilpons were notorious for trying to get their players not to get quote unquote fixed. My thing is, being in a union and knowing that the MLBPA is one of the strongest unions out there, why wouldn't a player go to the union or a couple of the players go to the union and go, hey, this is what they're doing to me. I know they want to file a grievance because they think I was hurt before the season when I signed, but they did all the medical tests on me. Why didn't they show up? So I would have pushed back, and maybe it's just because I'm a hard head, but if you're going to come at me with a grievance for me saying, hey, I want to go get surgery because I want to play for the team. I want to earn my money. I just don't want to get paid for being on the injured list. I would have went to the MLBPA and fought the Mets a little bit on it to get the surgery so I could fix myself. There's definitely no secrets about how shoddy the Mets medical team was over the years, who was actually calling the shots. And it was funny, my general practitioner, who's my doctor now, worked for the Mets, and he told me some stories about what went on behind the scenes and how he couldn't wait to get away from the team.
It's very interesting. I got one last topic, unless you guys have other things you want to get into. This mess with Major League Baseball's partnerships, or, you know, working partnerships with the independent leagues, the Atlantic League, the American Association, the Frontier League. They all have these working relationships now, and where MLB is going to experiment with all kinds of rules, experimentation, et cetera. Me personally, I attend Long Island Duck games from time to time. I've seen the electronic strike zone implemented in effect, and the call on the field, as far as I can tell, is seamless. The umpire is reacting to pitches. Somehow, some way, the information is being communicated to the home plate umpire, and for the batter's sake, is making the strike or ball call. I don't notice, you know, that it's being the genesis is electronic. I didn't notice it, although I see the equipment. It was a pretty seamless operation insofar as I can tell. But, Rich, baseball is starting to go way too far, and they're using the independent leagues for their experimental labs. This latest venture, you know, just makes me break out in a rash. They want to move the mound back by a foot. This is not new. They discussed this throughout the offseason. But I'll let you pick it up, Rich, and educate us on this matter.
Well, it's something that, as you said, Mike, MLB has a relationship with the Atlantic League, and they kind of test out their cockamamie ideas with the Atlantic League and to see how they go. And one that, you know, the electronic strike zone is something you could point to and say, you know, you have more experience with it than I do from what you said, but you could point to it and say it's done in the spirit of getting the calls right and taking – you know, error out of the game. I'm good with that. I don't love the idea of an automated strike zone, but okay, if it's done for the right reasons, I could get there. You know, the idea of starting a runner at second base and all these things that we've seen, well, not seen, it's actually happening. Okay, you know, they tried these things out. I don't like that either. But seven-inning doubleheaders, okay, you know, none of this is, while I have mixed feelings about some of these things, actually some of them I do like, none of them are huge to me, like huge changes to the game. The runner on second base, maybe, in extra innings. But this is something that, to me, you are fundamentally changing a game that's been around for 126 years, I believe it is, something like that. You're moving the mount, you're moving the rubber back a foot. Ron Darling, and I'm no physicist, but Ron Darling said last night that would make a 94-mile-an-hour fastball play out like a 91-mile-an-hour fastball, okay? So now you're affecting the number of strikeouts, you know, like take it to DeGrom. He's on the way to, you know, maybe breaking some strikeout records. He will strike out fewer hitters. Yes, there's a chance that if you're a foot farther back, that the break on the breaking ball, because the break becomes more profound as the ball slows down, and it slows down every inch it's moving. So maybe the breaking ball is a little sharper. But you're talking about slowing the speed of the pitch down. So, you know, what's Edwin Diaz going to throw? What is his 100 going to be? Is it going to be 96, 95? You're impacting the records of baseball in a huge way. I am adamantly against this. I hope it flops in the independent league. I'm equally adamantly against moving the bases, which they want to try to do as well, and I think they are going to do, where they're going to move the bases 18 inches. This stuff that if you want to affect the length of the game and try these various things, yes, I know that will have an ancillary impact on stats, seven-inning doubleheaders, you don't have as many at-bats, okay, maybe. But the impact to me there is fairly minimal. If you're going to move the bases, move the mound back, now every record that exists in baseball is going to be pre this nonsense, and there's not going to be a post this nonsense thing, because everything that happens on the field will be impacted. I don't see it. I want to hear what you guys have to say. I don't know. You're trying to have more balls put in play by making the pitcher less effective. Really? Is that it? Is that the way you do this? I mean, this one really bothers me. So I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say.
Keith, like Rich said, he brought up a lot of rule changes. Many of them make me break out in a rash. This particular rule change, moving the mound back by a foot, they're calling it a double hook because they're incorporating the designated hitter into this. That's not going to be a full-time position now. They're trying to interlock the designated hitter with the length of a starting pitcher. It's all too contrived. And the thing about this is Theo Epstein is also involved in this for the sake of creating more action on the field, etc. Me personally, I would ban all analytical departments from every major league team in baseball. They're the ones ruining this game. And these rules, they're flawed in their launch. I think they're just completely taking the wrong approach into trying to rectify the ills that are making this a sickly game. So, Keith, pick it up, please.
I have a couple of different points with it. First of all, I think Manfred hates baseball. He's like Gary Bettman. They don't know what they're doing with the sport, their sports. And everything that was great about the sports, they're filtering out. Two, there's a thing that people have forgotten over the years, that all our ballparks now are pretty much cookie cutters, relatively same field, same dimensions and everything. Why can't we start bringing back, you know, like stadiums like the Polo Ground, where you have weird dimensions? That would give different plays on balls. You know, it would give, hey, this, if you hit this way, it's easy to homer. If you hit this way, good luck. You might as well start running now. You might have an inside the park home run. I feel that there's other venues that they could do to speed up the game, to make the games more fun. The game length, it's there's two men. There's strategy and then there's over strategy, and I feel like the analytic departments and the managers just go way too much into matchups and trying to figure out, oh, let's put the, you know, this pitcher versus this batter because of this. How about if you're a major league batter and you're a major league pitcher, you should be able to either try to strike out the batter or hit off the pitcher and just be what you are. That's what you get paid to do, be a major league player. And then my last thing I'm going to say is if you're going to use the independent leagues as basically lab experiments, pay the players. Pay all your minor league players the right living wage. And none of these guys should have to be worried about where their next paycheck or their next meal is going to come from. If you're going to use these guys that if you're doing moving the mound back or the pitching rubber back a foot, you're going to screw up their career if you don't, you know, move the rubber back. So what are you going to do? Screw them up, and then in the future, if they don't make the major leagues, it has to do with their velocity getting screwed up, or the way they threw for a year, or they got hurt because of the way they had to throw, or the way they hit, or something. There's so much going on with this whole situation that, like, it drives me crazy. I try to think of good ways to fix things, and it's just like, you gotta just tweak something. You don't have to go full-blown craziness.
Sam, once upon a time, baseball was noted for being the perfect game. 90 feet was the perfect distance. 60 feet, 6 inches was the perfect distance. What happened? Pick it up.
Is just to reiterate, they have already changed this in the Atlantic League, and they are experimenting in the Atlantic League with distance?
Second half of the
season. This season, they're going to move the mound back 1 foot.
Oh, so, and that complicates things too, because just in terms of the actual mound and its position in the grass. So are you moving it back a foot and changing the way that you make the mound? Or does the entire configuration of where the grass is being planted have to change as well? I have so many questions about it, and I wish I didn't have to ask them, because this is ridiculous.
Well, mechanically, you can facilitate the change. You know, the mound, you can rebuild. You just move the rubber back, you redig it. They got to bleed into the grass and reconfigure the circle. They can do that. That's mechanical. That can be done. But the ramifications of doing this, I mean, I could see every curveball slider bouncing a foot before the plate, for that matter. But I'll let you continue. I'm sorry.
So, like, what if it's an immediate complete failure? Are they just going to, like, completely abandon it on the fly and just ask the hardworking field managers to immediately?
Well, therein lies the spirit of experimentation.
Therein lies the spirit of experimentation. And I guess that part of me wishes they were experimenting on the parade grounds with one pick-me-up game. Instead, just like, there's ways that you can simulate this stuff without having to completely implement it for half of the – I mean, like, what if – have they explained to us exactly, like, what the data is showing as to why they're experimenting with this? You know, it's just like, there's obviously – we know that there are ways to manifest what this actually does outside of, you know, actual gameplay. I mean, it's like you said, they have this interesting partnership with Independent League. But I mean, like, what do you think as a Long Island Ducks fan, Mike?
I'm trying to play along. I'm trying to observe and, you know, arrive to some kind of conclusion as to what they're doing. Some of these rules still need to be implemented, and I'm still yet to see them. But like I said, I went into the electronic strike zone opposed to it, naturally. But watching it in action, I can say it was a seamless operation. I see the equipment, and the umpire, like I said, for sake of balls and strikes on the field, for batter's knowledge, and continuity of the game, the umpires are making seamless calls. There were not one, not two, three instances where Frank Viola, former Met pitcher and coach at the time of the, I believe, the North Carolina team. It was one of the expansion teams. I might be wrong about the location. But he went out there and argued balls and strikes and got ejected because they were being electronically call. And the umpire is like, you can't fight with me about it. It's out of my hands. And Frank, he flipped out. He admitted so on a podcast. He was like, I didn't know what to do. I flipped out. And there's one instance, a former major leaguer, he hates it. He completely hates it. And we discussed last podcast about, you know, eliminating and purging the humanism away from the game of baseball. It's not good. But like I also said, Theo Epstein is behind some of this, working for the offices of Major League Baseball, trying to create more action on the field. And like I said, get rid of analytics. You know, I forgot which game it was. My recollection is spotty on this one because a lot of games I watch, the sound is off, and I got something else going on in the background. But insofar as defensive shifts with men on base, to me, is one of the more asinine things analytics departments ever dreamed up of. You are times literally giving a runner on second, third base, because you have three infielders on the right side of the infield. That's ponderous to me. And just the other day, the Mets shifted. Lindor was, I think, straight up the middle. He had to go deep to his right in order to field the ball. But by the time he got to it, there was nothing he can do with it because of the shift with runners on base. With runners on base, think about that for a second. You were just literally giving bases away. If any of you guys want to comment about that or anything else that's on your mind before we try to wrap this up. Rich, I'll start with you.
The thing about the shift is, again, I go back to the basics on that one. The way to beat it is to beat it on the field. You know, legislating it out of the game, I know you didn't suggest that, is just no. Look, if you want to do that, if you want to give away third base because your third baseman is playing, you know, over towards shortstop and has to stay there when the pitch is traveling and would have to try to beat the runner who got a huge lead and would have to try to beat the runner to third base, do it. That's the way to stop it. Take those bases. If they're giving them to you, take them. And then when a base hit scores two instead of one, screw the other team. Well, you know, that's going to stop this nonsense. And this idea that, you know, the general shifting and Jay Bruce saying it kind of sucks that I hit a ball, you know, 210 feet and I get thrown out by a guy playing short right field. Well, you know, Jay, the whole left side is open. You know, and I'm going to say it again. I said this last podcast and say the same words again. I wrote about this on MMO, and somebody said, oh, you make it sound like it's so easy to go the other way. Is it easy to sit there and try to swing from your ass and hit a home run every time? I mean, is the other option somehow easy? This is – you see the smart hitters beat the shift by going the other way. We've seen Todd Frazier take like that butcher boy swing and push it through the right side. You see guys lay down bunts. Not enough of them do it. But the way to stop this nonsense is to – it's a flaw. It's like the press in basketball. When two guys face the guy with the ball, you know what that means? That means somebody's open. The way to beat the full court press is to throw to the open guy. And is it easy? No, it isn't. But that's the way you stop this stuff is by when they shift, when they give you bases, that means that they have a defensive flaw now somewhere. Exploit that defensive flaw. To me, Mike, the problem isn't so much that teams do these things. It's that the other team doesn't take advantage of it enough.
I agree with you, Rich. And Keith, you know, once upon a time in baseball history, if you didn't have power or if you were didn't wield an extraordinary bat, at the very least, if you were bad at situational hitting, you did not make the major leagues.
It's amazing that hitters can't hit through a shift, or they can't even lay down bunts anymore. The fundamentals in the game seems like they're gone. It's all about, the arc of when the way they're upswinging at the ball. Everybody's going for power. Everybody's trying to hit into the outfield instead of just trying to get on base. And it's just amazing that it baffles me when you have a whole side of the field open that you don't even lay down a bunt, that you don't even try to adjust your swing where you're going to rip the ball down the third baseline or down the first baseline. When I play softball, there's times I get into a groove where I'm just pulling to the right, and I have to get back inside my head where I got to adjust my stance, and dip my shoulder, my left shoulder in, so I can hit in a different area. So I'm not hitting the same spot all the time. And I just don't get why major league players and AAA players haven't worked on it to that point where they make themselves better all around hitters and not have to worry about a shift being put up against them.
It's terrible. Sam, I'll let you go anywhere you want with that. But first, I'll throw this to you as well. You know, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that today was Jackie Robinson Day, and we had a podcast early in the afternoon to celebrate that. But what a shame that, you know, the rain postponed today's game. We didn't get to see all the players wearing number 42. We didn't get to see an on-field celebration of some sort or a video tribute. And fans, you know, weren't allowed the ability to walk up to the big number 42 in the rotunda and take a picture today. That's a shame. You know, they're going to make up for it. But Mother Nature said no. And, you know, again, today's Jackie Robinson Day. And I bid everyone a thoughtful and mindful Jackie Robinson Day. Sam?
You know, as we talked about on the podcast today, that it doesn't really get talked enough what he meant to that era as much as it is talked about, and that there needs to be a little bit more dialogue about both the positive and the negative, because sometimes it seems to get a little bit they seem to shy away from the really negative elements that just show us the ugly nature of what he had to endure. I think it's important that stuff gets talked about as well. And when we're talking about manufacturing runs, there may still to this day not be a bigger manufacturer of runs than Jackie Robinson, who was able to distract on the base paths just to get around a home plate and sometimes directly from third base on a pitch coming to the batter. It's pretty brilliant what he was able to do. And I think that, you know, that needs to be part of the study of Jackie Robinson Day for some of these players and these ball teams, that they really need to have the discussion, whether it's, you know, together with some historian coming in to talk about it, you know, just like what it was like to, you know, and I'll also mention this, like I remember I was at a breakfast at the Hard Rock Cafe in 2012 that Terry Collins was there with Mike Francesa was interviewing him. And I remember them talking about how a lot of these players these days don't really have a complete understanding of the history of the game. Some of them might still be students of the game, but you don't necessarily get the Keith Hernandez or even the Ken Griffey Jr. who was able to be around baseball history his entire life. You know, yes, you have the Fernando Tatis Jr.'s here, but even just the other day, you know, everything's becoming so different in terms of the way everybody takes in information. That even, I forget what the, Anthony Edwards, a basketball player, didn't even know who A-Rod was. you know, yeah. So I think that there needs to be a little bit more education of history is the point I'm trying to make.
Just to make a point in Jackie Robinson Day, I saw something, we've heard this and I saw it in the movie, but I've lost sight of this quote. And I just think it's fantastic. And I'm actually going to try to find it on Amazon or something and buy it and frame it and put it in my office. Someone asked Branch Rickey why he brought Jackie Robinson up, why he thought it was okay. And the quote goes that he said, because someday I'm going to meet God and God's going to ask me why, if I didn't let him play, God's going to ask me why. And if I said it was because of the color of the man's skin, I don't think that's going to be a sufficient answer. And that is such a great quote. And I know, you know, we had Frank Howard on, and, you know, and we've heard the Branch Rickey stories from Ralph Kiner and all that. But you take that quote that I just said, and that's powerful. That's really powerful. And I remember when he said it in the movie, like it caught my attention. And I saw it today on Twitter, so I wanted to share that.
Keith, happy Jackie Robinson Day.
Yeah, every time I hear about Jackie Robinson Day, I'm still waiting for the Jackie Robinson Museum on Varick and Canal Street to open up. It's been supposed to have opened up for years. And one of the I've been dying for it to open up because I want people to be able to walk in and be immersed in his story and see stuff from his career and videos from his career where it's tangible and it's in front of you. And it's just not, you know, a passing story on TV from a ball game. One of the coolest things I've been able to do is when I travel to go watch baseball is I went to the Negro League Museum in Kansas City. And that was just such a well-done museum, and I learned so much stuff there. And I want the Jackie Robinson Museum to be like that here in New York. And I don't know why it keeps getting delayed. I just know that it's on the corner of Canal and Varick, and I just keep waiting for it to open up. And I think, like how you were saying, that a lot of people aren't getting the information or being immersed in baseball history. I think if somebody could go in there, and if you're traveling, in a baseball team's traveling into New York to play the Mets or the Yankees, that might be something that they want to stop off in on their off day, or, you know, if they have an afternoon game and they keep the museum open for the players, the visiting players, you know, afterwards or whatever. I think that's something that is really lacking. And I love the fact that Major League Baseball has Jackie Robinson Day. I kind of, the other thing is with everybody wearing 42 on their jerseys, I kind of feel it dilutes Jackie Robinson a little bit, or maybe they should pick somebody from the team that exemplifies what Jackie Robinson meant to the team, or honor, or be able to honor Jackie Robinson by that player wearing it, that it might bring more recognition to it and have people want to learn more about Jackie Robinson. Sure, it was a great movie with Chadwick Boseman, and people know the name, but I think there needs to be more done.
Well said. A life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives. Jackie Robinson said that. So unless anybody has any outstanding issues, comments, or rude remarks, I will move on.
Well, I'll just say, I guess
yeah,
this is the rude remark. the rude remark is you wonder if the next generation of Hall of Famers are going to make it into the Hall of Fame without having ever gone to the museum. So you wonder what the percentage, if surveyed, of the ballplayers would say they have been to the Hall of Fame and museum up in Cooperstown, New York. So, I'm very curious about that number, and you hope that they're still having the Hall of Fame game. What's the deal with the Hall of Fame game? Because at least that helps, you know, spread it around the league. Because I'm sure they tour during those games. If anybody can speak to that,
I'm not quite sure what's been going on lately. I know at one point they stopped it, but I can't speak much else about the Hall of Fame game. But Doubleday Field up there in Cooperstown is a nice little pretty piece of real estate. It really is. And, Sam, I hope they kick that up if it's not already done. But you're right. There's so much more that needs to be done. Baseball is blowing it, so maybe it's perhaps up to us fans to get this campaign back into high gear. I don't know. We'll have to see. In the meantime, if there's no other issues, guys, going once. Going twice, sold. Into our final word. This is the way we close out the show. It's free form. It's gonzo. It's anything that's on your mind. I'll start with Rich just to give you an idea of what we're up to. So, Rich, your final word, please.
My final word would be rhythm. The Mets need to establish a sense of rhythm. It's not their fault that they haven't been able to play these games, but it will be nice to get into that rhythm and see what this team really is, because let's face it, in 8 games, we've had 2 seasons. When they were 2-3, we were all screaming, at least I was, you know, the offense is too much this, it's going to be inconsistent, you know, blah, 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 crazy. Now they've won 3 in a row since then. Pitching has been dynamic. The offense is starting to wake up, so that's the other version of the Mets. So who are the real Mets? Don't know. Only way we're going to find out is when the team gets in a real rhythm and starts playing every day. So my word is rhythm.
Keith, thank you so much for joining the Mets Team Podcast this evening. It's been a pleasure absorbing your insights and gathering in your knowledge, learning about the Queens Baseball Convention. I will go to you for your final word. And please, one more short plug, what you're doing and where we can find it, sir.
Check out my blog, themediagoon.com, fan advocacy blog, queensbaseballconvention.com for all things Queens Baseball Convention, and the 2 Twitter handles, @mediagoon and @QBconvention. The word I'm going to go with is enjoy. Baseball's back. It's somewhat normal. I was able to go with the opening day. It was great being able to sit in the field with the 7 line, watching baseball, not having a care in the world for a change, and just being able to relax and enjoy watching the game live. So if anything over the last year, just enjoy what you have and what you can enjoy, whether it's baseball, whatever, Mets sucking, Mets doing good. Just enjoy that you have something to watch and help you forget about things for a couple hours.
Thank you again on behalf of Rich and Sam for joining us this evening. Keith Blacknick, go to his website, themediagoon.com, co-founder of the Queens Baseball Convention. Sam, I'm going to get mine out of the way because that's as become my tradition of like handing the baton to you to close things out. I'm going to say remorse. We just finished up the series with the Phillies, and, you know, we faced Zach Wheeler. It wasn't his best start, but I just can't help with the Lowry news today, the money we spent on him, Michael Walker and Rick Porcello, you know, that money should have been going into Zach Wheeler's pockets. I miss him. I got attached to him. I wish he was a Met today. Remorse. That's my final word. So, Sam, on to you.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you, Keith, once more for joining us, and thank you, Rich. It's always great to talk to you. And, you know, I think my final word, you know, kind of jumping off of what Keith was talking about, taking in a game, I have yet to do so, but I'm going to be fully vaccinated, I believe, by the time that this single admission doubleheader Jackie Robinson Day coming, I believe, June 25th, they said. I would love to be able to go to a game by then, and I hope to do so, take in some baseball. And I'll also speak to, I think there were some really good signs with the way the Mets held themselves together after failing really in many places to get the big hit until these last few games with the Phillies. It was a good statement against a division rival, you know, early on, and hopefully they don't get snowed out tomorrow, because I hear that could be a possibility in Colorado. So we will see. We shall see. One way or another, I'm sure they can play through some light flakes, although apparently it's going to be like 32 degrees. Hopefully they can get some games in. They can stay warm. To all of you out there, hope you enjoy your weekend. Thank you for listening. Let's take in some more baseball, and let's keep this momentum going. The only way to finish this out is let's go Mets. Let's go
let's
Mets.
Go Mets.
Let's go Mets.
Go
let's
Mets.
Go Mets. Take care, everybody. Thanks again, guys.
Good night, all. Good night, Mets, Bill.
Bye, guys.
Later, Rich. Later, Mike.
Good night.